Hey guys, it's your favorite sisters with the Confessions of a Reluctant Caregiver show on UK Health Radio. On the show, you'll hear caregivers confessing the good, the bad, and the completely unexpected. You're guaranteed to relate, be inspired, leave with helpful tips and resources, and of course, laugh. Now, let's jump right in to today's guest confession. Hey, Jay.
Hey, Natalie.
How are you doing this morning?
You know, I got some coffee and I'm feeling great.
Yeah, I've got water and I realized before we started I needed to pee.
That's way too much for us to start. The audience doesn't want to hear that.
Yeah, let's get started. Okay. This is going to be such a good show and I'm very excited. And we've got a mother-daughter and we've never had a mother-daughter combo.
Today we have with us Molly McCloskey-Healy and Maureen McCloskey. Mm-hmm. And first of all, I'd like to say they are a mother and daughter team.
Yeah.
I love teams. They have been caregivers. They are caregivers. They will be caregivers and they will need to be cared for. I say they are the reason why Rosalind Carter, that's why she made
she
her
that statement.
They are that statement.
Yeah.
Both have healthcare backgrounds and I think that's a path that they were both destined and chose to take, Nat. Mm-hmm. Today, we're going to talk about ALS. We're going to talk about Alzheimer's. We're going to talk about frontotemporal dementia and even the recognition that you are predestined to become you're predestined to those because of a mutated gene that is actually already recognized because of some testing. Hmm. So I want to welcome. Today Maureen McCloskey.
Morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Yay. And Molly.
Hi. Good morning, everybody.
Hey, good morning.
Yay. We're so excited to have you guys. So I know this is the first time we're having two. You know, we did have two people. It was a husband and wife, but they were in the same frame.
Yeah.
And so this is we've got one person in Philadelphia.
Right.
Maureen's in Philadelphia. And then Molly, you're in Kansas City, right?
Yes.
Okay. So normally we always, JJ and I were talking about to make sure that we really got the story out. Normally I always talk about, tell us, you know, from the beginning, tell us about yourself. And I'm going to actually ask both of you to tell us a little bit about yourself. And I'm going to start with Maureen. If you want to tell us a little bit about your background growing up and a little bit about your family, because this, I know that your care started with your mom, but care has permeated throughout the entire family.
Right.
So Maureen, and then Molly, we'll jump to you after we chat with your mom. So Maureen, you're on the hot seat. So tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, your sibs, all that good stuff.
Very good. As I said, happy to be here. I am one of four children. I was born and raised in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Actually, I live in the home. I bought the home that I was raised in from my parents about 23 years ago at this point. Mm-hmm. My parents are both deceased at this time. I am the youngest of four children. I have an older sister and two older brothers. I'm married now and have three wonderful children and one granddaughter. I'm a nurse by background. I'm a pediatric nurse and have worked at the same facility for 38 years.
Wow.
Back in 2020, I switched my career path a little bit and became an infection preventionist at the same institution. So I've been an infection preventionist, still holding my nursing license and practicing as a nurse, but also now certified in infection control.
Mm-hmm.
Since 2020. Unfortunately, that happened during the pandemic when they were in highest need. And I took this little career path just to help out for a little while, but really found the liking to it, better work-life balance, and a whole kind of a different world to be a part of and liked it. So took a full-time position at that time.
Mm. Do you think that switch in positions potentially helped you with caring for your mom?
So it's interesting. It actually happened around the same time. So this switch happened in 2020, just as my mom was, I guess this position started before my mom started with symptoms, but shortly after I took the position, My mother did have surgery, and then symptoms of ALS started to appear at that time. And yes, I do think that this has helped me because it's a much more flexible position. I am able to work from home. My days off can be a little bit more in the moment than when I was at the bedside doing nursing, where things needed to be a little bit more scheduled out.
That's true.
Shows how important that employers are
I'm telling you right
to
now,
caregivers.
employers and flexibility and caregiving, I think that's such a big thing that we always want to say out loud because, 7 out of 10 caregivers also work full-time or part-time. And they not only need to do that, want to do that as well, whether it's financial reasons, just honestly a sanity check. And so, okay, let's switch over to Molly. Molly.
Hi, yes, so happy to be here. I am 30 years old and recently got married. I guess I'm going a little bit backwards, but I'm from Philadelphia. I was born and raised there for the first 28 years of my life until a couple years ago. My now husband is an Air Force pilot, so we are out here in Kansas City now for that. But I grew up with my two siblings, my younger brother, my older sister, my parents, and a very large family, very loving large family, which was, a great experience for me with cousins and aunts and uncles always around, my grandparents. So we're all very close and grew up and went to school in Philadelphia. I went to high school right in Center City of Philadelphia, and then went to Temple University for my undergrad degree and graduated from there and also commissioned as an officer in the Army through the Army ROTC program at Temple. So now I currently work in pharmaceuticals, but as a case manager for a rare disease drug, a couple of rare disease drugs for neuromuscular rare disease. Was doing that previously with the ALS community and now working with the myasthenia gravis and neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder diagnoses. So that is kind of where I'm at now, but I spent a couple of years trying to find my way a little bit and was in the healthcare setting. I was at the same hospital as my mom for a couple of years, which was so fun. And then at the VA for a little while and as an organ transplant coordinator. So I've kind of had a little bit of a taste of everything when it comes to case management in the healthcare world and then switched over to pharmaceuticals in the last like 5 years or so.
So that's very interesting. I will just ask if your past at the time, I know that you were in college and you've come up to that 30, which is very young, I will
She is a
say.
puppy.
You are just a puppy.
She's a pup.
Have some of your experiences as caregivers and then knowing and being familiar with ALS and Alzheimer's and other diseases, have those led you down the path that you choose to go, Molly? Has that kind of given you some insight?
Yes. So actually, up until my grandmother had been diagnosed and then passed of ALS, I was still in the healthcare side of the world of, healthcare and in like a clinical setting. And I think she passed in October of 2021. And in about December, so maybe like 8 weeks after that, I stumbled across a company that was looking for case managers in the pharmaceutical world for a drug that was going to be coming to market for ALS, actually. So it was a little bit of like a, oh my gosh, did she just plop this down into my lap? I was not really looking for a job, but had I was actually creating a LinkedIn for the first time because I hadn't had one. And right in front of me was this job posting of, we are looking for people who can help with patients gaining access to new therapy, but we want people to be familiar with the disease that is ALS because a lot of our role was kind of helping people guide through that newly diagnosed period and getting access to new therapy. So it really felt like fate a little bit. And I absolutely loved my time at the first company that I worked for. And then have since moved on to another company and really kind of continued on that path. And I definitely see myself going further, in that direction and a little bit more in the world of like advocacy and patient access to kind of helping people with navigating the rare diseases that they have. So it's definitely been a large part of my own career journey to just have been exposed to ALS through my family.
Yeah, very interesting.
So I want to, Maureen, I want to jump back to you. This is much more fun.
This is
I'm
fun.
like, this is fun.
Jumping
Let's go
back.
back on the
Okay.
other episode with Maureen. Hey, Maureen, I want to go ahead and let's talk about your mother and ALS and that diagnosis? And is this, I'd like to get a little bit more background about when she was diagnosed, but did the family know that this is a genetic issue? And let's talk about what care was like, because I know, Molly, you stepped in as well intermittently, and then especially towards the end of really helping to support your mom. And we'll come back to you. So, Maureen, let's jump back on with you and give us some background on that and tell us kind of what happened.
Sure. It was difficult to kind of figure out what was going on with my mom. She had very healthy, 82 years old, very independent. My father had passed away in 2016. And she kind of found her way without him with the support of the family. Mm-hmm. But in 2020, she was very active and started to have some difficulty with moving around, kind of being as independent as she wanted. She was bowling. She was going to aerobics. She would go swimming. She was going out with her friends. She had a really close community. On top of having family close by, keeping her very busy. We had taken her to an orthopedic because her right knee was kind of really bothering her, which she had had trouble before with that. They actually did a knee replacement in June of 2020, mm-hmm. For which she recovered very well from. I moved in with her for a couple weeks at that time to get her through, you know, get her back to being independent. And she made it through everything really well. But then about... In the beginning of August, we started to notice a couple of slight changes in her that just weren't adding up. Her voice became very hoarse. She seemed to be clearing her throat a lot, having difficulty talking on the phone sometimes. Huh. People were telling me, people being family and like my mom's siblings and my siblings telling me, oh, it's all because she had surgery and she had, you know, a tube down, she was intubated, and her voice is just hoarse. It's probably a vocal cord thing. So started with ENT, took her to an ENT. They looked down and they were like, her vocal cords are fine, but we do see that she doesn't have a lot of ability to push air out, which may be impacting her voice.
Hmm.
So they wanted us to go to a pulmonary doctor, for which took a little while. And in the meantime, between August and September, when we were going to see the pulmonary doctor, she fell twice. Was kind of back to independence, was using a walker still because of the knee replacement, but was working her way towards a cane. And she was kind of hesitant to go out of the house. And unfortunately, maybe fortunately at this point, my brother and I encouraged her to get out and start walking her neighborhood the way she used to. And that first kind of loop around, she got back and her legs just kind of gave out on her and wow. She wasn't able to get up. Luckily she did not get injured because she was able to lower herself down, but it was pretty significant that something else was wrong with her legs at this point. Mm-hmm. I went down the path, got her to the pulmonary doctor for that appointment, and the pulmonary doctor did his pulmonary test and listened to her lungs and agreed that he was seeing something that was not allowing her to push air out to make her voice strong. Mm-hmm. But he actually noticed that her hands were getting to be a little bit debilitated. Her muscles were wasting around her thumbs, mm-hmm. which, you know, I was like, I'm looking at my thumb right now.
And I'm like, I don't know that there was muscles in my thumb that, but I'm like, okay, right? Keep going.
I look at it all the time now. And I said to him, does that have anything to do with why we're here?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I want you to go to a neurologist. So I was like, okay, do I have to worry about her lungs at this point? And he said, no, but, he referred us to a neurologist who did the full exam, kind of looked over her, was starting to put some pieces together and basically paused and said, I think you need a specialist. And I said, well, aren't you a specialist? Like, isn't that why we're here?
Yeah.
And he said, no, I need you to go to a bigger university hospital. I need you to see a neuromuscular specialist.
Wow.
And, you know, I said, why? And he said, I don't want to start looking into things. I just know that this is not going to be something that I would handle. Wow. So sent us down to the University of Penn, where we saw lessons learned in the background. We saw a general neuromuscular neurologist who kind of repeated the same exam, decided that my mom needed to have some testing done and gave us the idea that maybe this was ALS. and kind of blew my mind. I looked at him and looked at my mom, and you know, my mom said, "Do you mean Lou Gehrig's disease? Like, that is what you think I have?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Oh, I don't have that. Like, nobody in my family has that. That's something that you don't just get that." And you know, he kind of paused and he said, "Let's just do the testing and we'll come back to it."
Hold on, hold that thought for just a second, Maureen, because we need to take a break.
Let's jump. Yeah.
So we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
All right, everybody, we are back and we're right now at the cusp of, you have been through a lot of testing and finally you may have reached that point where they give you the answer to what's going on with your mom, Maureen. Go ahead.
Yes. So we were called back after the testing was done and called in with the same neuromuscular doctor who confirmed that his thoughts were very strongly ALS.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he wasn't the person that could actually diagnose it. So we yet again were sent to an ALS specialist. And it was a whole team of doctors that run a clinic specifically for ALS. So we got there pretty quickly. We you know, this all started with the neurologist in November, December of 2020. Mm-hmm. And we saw the ALS team in February of 21.
Wow.
And at that time, my mom had progressed a little bit more things were happening. She was definitely falling more, definitely dependent on a walker. Her voice was low, although she could speak clearly. She was eating and, you know, drinking all of that fine. But when we got to the specialist, they confirmed that it was ALS.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, the two of us were sitting in a room saying, like, how is this possible? Like, what does this mean? Where are we going from here? So we did get educated. We were actually brought back in early March for a full team evaluation, which is how ALS clinics work, where you see the physician, you see a nurse practitioner, you see all of the specialists, the respiratory mm-hmm. therapist, occupational therapist, the physical therapist,
right.
speech therapist, nutritionist. They kind of pull the whole team together for all of the systems to get impacted with ALS. So I was the primary person, mm-hmm. primary caregiver. I was her health advocate in definition from when my father passed. They kind of named a financial person and a health person within our family. So my sister took on the role of the financial person as she works in a bank and has the finances, you know, tight. I do not have finances tight. So that would not have been a good role for me. You know, because of my nursing background, but also I helped to take care of my father. My father had been diagnosed with leukemia in 2015 and passed in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, kind of took that role on there, which then, you know, fell to just who I was going to be for my mother from the get-go.
So you would say it was assumed. Like, you took care of your dad, so of course you're going to take care of your mom. You go to all the appointments, you're the nurse, you're qualified, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And yes, yes.
That's
a whole new world, though, again, because I knew nothing of ALS.
Oh, that's so shocking, you know, because you're a nurse. You should know everything.
I thought nurses knew everything.
I know.
It doesn't matter.
That's so interesting because we have so many family members who say they have that medical background, but in actuality, they learn so much. So I want to talk about, because now this is about you, I want to talk about the time with your mom. And how was your time spent with your mother? Do you feel like that was a precious time that you were able to spend, or was it more time that you were very duty driven, where you were
task driven,
like I have to make sure mom is comfortable? How did you balance the two?
I think it was complicated. I took the role and I would never have let anybody else have the role. I mean, I am that person who kind of takes control in many situations and needs to have that control. So I think that just kind of fell in my lap that way. With my siblings, what I did was you know, that first day when we came home, you know, I got them all on the phone with my mom in the room, and we explained what was going on. I have to say my brothers were a little bit lost in it. They were like, okay, well, that's fine. Like, you know, she's 82 years old. Of course she's going to fall. Of course she's going to need a walker. Of course this. Maybe it's not actually that.
Mm-hmm.
My sister needed more details on the side, so she needed the phone call afterwards to kind of sit and kind of walk her through it. I, you know, offered, took, you know, identified myself as the person who would go to all of her appointments with her. She did progress fairly quickly, so mm-hmm. we needed to get some care in the home. We had the tough conversation. She lived alone in the home that her and my father had purchased in their retirement time period. So it was one floor. It was easy access. It was made wide for wheelchairs. It was like the perfect place for her to be able to stay, except that she lived by herself. So she chose very strongly that she was not leaving her home. My father stayed at home and passed away in the house, you know, in their bedroom. And that is where she wanted to be. She wanted to be in her home and not be moved from there. None of my siblings nor myself, our homes were going to be conducive to having her move in with us. We all have steps. It would have taken construction to have her move in. And I knew that we didn't have time for construction. There was no point in trying to do that. So we worked with her. Again, financially, my father was kind of set her up for success of staying in the home. Mm-hmm. We were able to hire some caregivers through a home care company mm-hmm. who were able to come in and assist during the daytime with her. You know, and initially it started out with like 4 hours a day, and then we went up to 8, and then we went up to 12 with my siblings kind of popping in. Quickly, I identified that my siblings and I needed a schedule. Mm. We needed direction, or they needed direction, and they didn't need to depend on me to be there to kind of with them. I wanted them to have some, one, independence on caring for her, giving me a break, but also time with her without other people around.
Yeah.
So we set up time. You know, they each picked an evening, and they would show up on their day at like 5 o'clock and stay with her until she went to bed. Once she was in bed, she was generally okay. We had to have lots of talks about not getting up after we put her in bed, you know, staying in bed. We put a commode next to her bedside.
Right.
So she could use that. She had multiple falls after people left the house, for which I was her call. So, you know, my husband and I, or my sister and I would get the call, and I would deploy whoever was needed to get up there to help get her picked up.
Yeah.
Luckily, all of her falls resulted in no injuries because she knew it was happening. So she had control. It was like a controlled fall where she would get to the ground, you know, and safely be there.
Yeah.
So over time, the things that I did were really organize her care and try to take that step back when my siblings were there so that I could have time with my family, continue that life. I was working full time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was going to work every day. The difficult part for me was if something happened or if my mom had a question, she called me.
Oh,
she didn't
want
to talk to anybody else. She wanted me.
Of course she did. Our mom does the same thing with JJ. Okay. So Molly, it's interesting because we've just heard your mom talk about kind of everything that's going on, and you're in college at this point, aren't you?
Just
graduated. I think you're in your.
It was right after college.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not 20s. That young. Yes. I was right after.
Yeah. So you're still a puppy. So this was after college, and you're watching this. So this is a perspective we've never had before. Tell us a little bit about observing and how you supported your mom, because I think that you were a caregiver to the caregiver too, because I feel like you and your mom have a pretty close relationship.
For my mom, I think I was watching her not burn out really, because I don't think my mom has the ability to burn out. But I think in a way where I definitely noticed that she was unfortunately not getting a mother-daughter relationship any longer. We had a lot of tough conversations about how she deserved to have time that was not in a wearing her caregiver hat with my grandmother, especially towards the end of her time where she was on hospice and much sicker. And it was, you know, my mom and myself there a lot of the time around the clock, and just reminding her that, you know, she deserves the most kind of out of everybody at this point, to really get that time with my grandmother before she passes. And I think that was kind of where I really started to have some harder conversations and really say, like, I know that you're have this task list, but let me take some of those things. I'll get the morphine prepared, things like that, that, you know, were hard for her to let go of. But at the same time, you know, I think reminded her that she deserved to also just be a child who was losing their parent, not just, you know, the nurse who was caring for, you know, a woman who had ALS. Oh.
Maureen, I want you to tell me that what did it mean for you, for Molly to say, you got to stop, take this time with your mom as your mom? If you could say something to Molly, what would it be?
It was an absolute wonderful idea. It was very difficult for me, as Molly led to. You know, I've already said that I'm the controller, I'm the caregiver, I'm the person, and I'm Molly's mom. So I hesitated on her needing to be present for the things that were going to happen with my mom. Mm-hmm. But Molly's just as headstrong as I am. And very much, you know, said, but this is what we're doing. I'm staying here. She went home to her apartment in Philly, and she packed her bag up and came back and then sent me home to pack my bag because I had been there for a couple of days without, you know, anything. And it meant the world to me. And to have that time, to know that when I was in the bedroom with my mom, spending that time talking to her, you know, being her daughter, recognizing that the end was coming. She was no longer able to speak to us at this point, but definitely was awake and alert, and able to communicate through, you know, signs, you know, squeezing the hand, looking around, those things. That time I would have never gotten back if Molly didn't step in at that moment. It was difficult because my siblings were there, but my siblings very much said, go for it, Molly. Like, you got this, you can do it, because they did not want to be in that situation of taking over the caregiving part of it.
Yeah. Mm. Well, it sounds like you guys are the perfect team. Maureen, your brother has also been diagnosed with ALS, and he's younger. I think he's in his 60s, and you are kind of being a caregiver for a caregiver again, because he's married. But with that, is that a genetic thing? You know, he's got that, but there's some genetic testing, or there's some testing that's gone on that Molly has found out. And so we're going to talk to Molly.
Sure.
All right.
We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So we're coming back. And so I kind of want to wrap up the piece with your mom. And it sounds to me, what I hear you saying, Maureen, is that you really were able to have that closure and be a daughter and not and really pull back on what I think most people feel of as a concurrent role, but typically the caregiver leans heavier into it. And I think that's such a blessing that Molly was able to do that, as well as other family members. But I know Molly, and I think you're blessed because of the positions that you went into. And so I think there was education that you knew. You were smarter, as I like to say, smarter than the average bear. And so, you know, Molly, when did you know? I want to go into the genetic testing. Yep. That's the part that I didn't realize about ALS. And Molly, I know that we talked about it on our phone call beforehand, and you shared with me so much information about that. But that also influenced your decision making earlier in your 20s, as you were thinking, as you found out about, like, this could be genetic and I need to think about this moving forward. And how do I choose to have kids? And how is this going to affect my spouse? And how do I have a conversation? So, Molly, do you want to jump into that and start chatting about that?
Yes, I will try to give the brief version. We have the very unique experience of having a pattern of ALS on both sides of our family, which is something that I think, now that I've been exposed to the ALS world a lot, I've met a lot of, you know, professionals in the ALS world, and most of them have never heard of that happening. So it's very unique. And I always say we should play the lottery more often, because, you know, it's the odds are really strong. But yes, we have the pattern from my grandmother on my mom's side and her brother now. There's been no genetic mutation found. My uncle's had every test possible, and there is many of them, to see if there's any connection between my grandmother's ALS diagnosis and his. And so far, nothing has been identified. There's a lot of other factors that really can play into that. ALS has, an unknown reason why people get it most of the time. Spontaneous ALS is really the more common. Familial ALS is a much smaller percentage. It's, I think they say 10%. I think it's probably now up to like 15 to 20% realistically.
Okay.
There's many genes that are identified, but there are still families like ours on my mom's side where, there is a pattern, but they don't really know why. And I think a lot of things that they think about are like environmental factors. My uncle is union worker. He was a steam fitter forever. So, there's definitely different things that can affect. I know you and I, Natalie, talked about how veterans have a higher rate of diagnoses of ALS as well. So there's a lot of things outside of genetic factors. But on my father's side of the family, we actually ended up having a diagnosis of a C9 mutation, which is an open reading frame mutation on your 9th chromosome. And that happened, I guess, with my uncle, I want to say like 2017. Mm-hmm. My mom can probably confirm about in there. So we did learn of ALS in my dad's side of the family prior to my grandmother's diagnosis.
Okay.
But it kind of was almost felt like an odd coincidence. You know, we really never thought too hard about it other than, well, that's really strange. That probably doesn't happen often. And we were at the same clinic with my grandmother that my uncle on my father's side had used. And I think they already kind of knew my family well enough because my dad's side of the family had already been connected with them. So that was really a blessing for us, I think, in the long run, because we were familiar with how the clinic works and the people in it and everything. Mm-hmm. But to my dad's side of the family, my uncle found out about his genetic mutation just because there was another brother of theirs who had, I think we don't really know the official diagnosis per se, but some form of a dementia that, led to his passing many years before that. You know, they would have never really connected it had they not gone over that family history with my uncle who had ALS. And from there, my dad and his siblings were tested for a genetic mutation. Everybody kind of had their own choice, which is really how the genetic counselors recommend that you do it. There's no pressure to find out about your genetic mutation. My father's was positive and his other siblings were negative, which was, I think, a huge blessing as well. You know, I mean, unfortunate for my father, of course, but his siblings that are still living were all negative. So we only had that one person who was really continuing from their siblings. And then from there, my sister and I chose to be tested for the same genetic mutation. I was positive. I won't share my sister's results because that's, her choice. But and my brother has not been tested yet, which again, we support him with that because it's really a very personal decision for every person who's in that position because it can have a lot of effects on your life. You know, I was young. I was, not in a place where I was going to be, with my long-term, my now spouse at the time. Mm-hmm. I was kind of like young, single, dating, had a lot of privilege in knowing the information when I did to make decisions for my long-term future. So I really took advantage of that. With that, I have it's kind of worse than having like a permanent STD when you're in the dating world too, because I'm like, I feel like I have to reveal this giant secret about a terminal illness just to know that, somebody's a good person and not gonna leave me if I'm looking for a husband. Luckily I found him. Yeah. But I was very lucky with that. And we have worked through a fertility clinic in freezing embryos and testing them. We're testing and then freezing embryos to use in our future.
Wow.
And children to eliminate the genetic mutation. Mm. And that really came a lot from my sister started doing a similar path she was at a different time when we were getting our genetic testing done. She had just gotten married and they were really ready to start having children. And so that was kind of the driving factor for her. And she had done a lot of research about, depending on what that result is, how would that affect their journey? And so she had kind of kicked that off. And then once I was kind of in a position where I was thinking about that. You know, I was able to really kind of dive right in and connect with.
That's so interesting that you can make that decision, though, to go ahead and freeze those eggs. And people don't know that if you
they may not know that you can
actually do that testing with that. You can do that testing prior to. So that's very interesting to me.
So what was the conversation? This is different, but, you know, you had a care conversation with your significant other, your boyfriend at the time, and you guys are talking about marriage. What was that conversation like, and how have you all planned thinking forward to the future beyond having children?
Yeah, I think it was awkward for sure. It was not normal for, you know, I was 25 probably or 26 mm-hmm. having this conversation. And for me, it was like, I was at a point where I was like, okay, I'm probably going to say I love you. And I think I want to like marry you at some point. And now I have to really reveal this giant secret before, because I have no interest in moving forward with somebody who, you know, isn't able to handle that, or who I don't perceive as being able to appropriately handle that or support me through it. So I was super lucky. But yeah, I just had a really blunt, which is kind of how I operate, blunt and direct, conversation about like, this is a real thing. And this is what will happen. And I know that it's not necessarily 100% for me, but I speak of it like that, so that there's no, you know, no shock to reality if and when it does happen. So, you know, I shared with him, you know, the research that I've done and what it means and, you know, how detrimental this can be in the future and what that would mean for us. And he's just the nicest person in the world. And he's a very strong, very, even keeled, very, I don't know just how to describe him, but he's like, not like me at all. I'm definitely, we balance each other out quite a bit with that. So he definitely is somebody who, you know, knew right away that it didn't matter what I would have. Of course, he would support me through it. And, you know, as we very early on talked about marriage, which was also, again, not really my, my MO previously to having this, you know, he was really focused on, you know, well, if we are talking about getting married, it's like through sickness and health and all the things. So that was very relieving to hear, because it almost unlocked, you know, the door into really being vulnerable and kind of moving our relationship to the next level in terms of, you know, a really long-term strong relationship rather than just dating at 25 or 26.
What is your kind of look at the future? I mean, are you out there because of your field, or you're like, we are going to find a cure for this? Like, is that what you see in your future?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely love to continue to be a part of that. I've really tried to take a deeper dive into different advocacy groups. My mom and I are both peer mentors through IMALS, which is who connected us with you all. And then just kind of making sure that I'm keeping up to date with, you know, what's happening in terms of, you know, different policies being passed, being involved with, you know, advocating with legislature, from writing letters and just being up to date on joining meetings and just showing support for any changes that are trying to be made. I'm a clinical study patient in a couple of different research studies that are being done. I go to the NIH once a year for some couple days worth of appointments to make sure I'm kind of doing my part in contributing to the research that's happening. And then working with a couple of different, a pharmaceutical company that's got a lot of good work going on, just working on like an advisory board with them so that they keep the kind of mindset of patients and caregivers in their mind when they're planning their clinical trial out. Mm.
So Maureen, can you tell me about your experience with doing peer support for others?
Absolutely. You know, Molly reached out to me a little while back and said, I think you would really do well with this. Connected me with IMALS. I did the training and got paired with a woman who absolutely is living my life as I did with my mom. Her situation is almost parallel with mine.
Wow.
It has allowed me to not just share like the practices that I was able to do and kind of look back on, you know, what worked for me, what didn't, to kind of share with her, to allow her, this woman, to kind of look at the options on how do you best prepare for this? You know, how do you communicate? How do you work with your siblings? How do you work with the healthcare field? What's available out there? I've kind of been able to lay that out for her and her family. But it has also allowed some healing with me. It has allowed me to kind of, you know, get away from the fact that my mom passed from ALS and look at, you know, that time that was spent with her before her diagnosis, during her diagnosis, and then absolutely that last week when Molly jumped in. And, you know, I say jumped in, as Molly said, her and her cousins were there all along. They were along for the ride.
Right.
Yeah. They were there helping. But, you know, towards the end there, it really has allowed me to kind of look at that bigger picture and see that, you know, there were rough times, and there were times that if I could go back and change something, I may. But generally, I had that time with my mom as both the caregiver, which is what she wanted, but also the daughter, and watched her, you know, become a great grandmother again. Shortly after my mom passed, my first granddaughter was born. So she didn't get to meet her, but she was very active in that pregnancy and knowing that, you know, we were having a baby and what that would mean. And I've been able to kind of put in, be the grandmother my mother was. I'll never match who my mother was as a grandmother, but, you know, definitely have learned a lot.
Yeah. My question would be advice that you would give someone that has a child that was, or it has been diagnosed, or they found that mutation that could possibly lead to this type of terminal illness. Advice that you would give a parent?
From a mom to a mom perspective, yeah. I would say, you know, support them, be there, listen to them, educate yourself. Molly got quickly educated and was educated on this C9 mutation much deeper than I was at the beginning. She really helped me understand, you know, what I needed to learn, but really to be there, be open, and be open to what each of the children want or don't want. You know, as Molly said, her and her sister chose to be tested. Her brother has not yet chosen that. But we all need to support each other as it is. My husband is, you know, does have the genetic mutation. He's at the prime age where his brother started with symptoms. And again, it was a very fast moving ALS that his brother passed with. So supporting him, he's involved in the research that Molly is, but just through another hospital. So kind of staying behind that and just being open to that and listen and become educated in this world of, you know, the unknown. I mean, this was something we did not know anything about prior to these situations.
Mm. And I'm going to end it with Molly too. Molly, any advice that you would give, to someone, any advice from a caregiving standpoint, that you would offer?
I think learning how to be an advocate in whatever way that your loved one needs is really important. And for us, obviously, we have a few different people who we need to do that for. And I think meeting whichever person it is, you know, where they're at with their diagnosis is really important. But learning how you can be a partner and a pair with them in it. But remember that it's their experience, and you can be there to support them and learn how to be an advocate by maybe getting a different perspective that, you know, it's hard for somebody who has a diagnosis to understand. But, you know, let them lead the way and just learn ways that you can support them and be involved. But I think my mom and I have both learned, especially the difference with my grandmother and my uncle, and then, you know, thinking about our own personalities, I think in the future of every journey is going to be extremely different and look very different. And there's ways to support and advocate for each different one. And I think that's the most powerful thing that you can really do for somebody who has a diagnosis like ALS or really like any, you know, terminal or long-term chronic illness.
Mm. So I will say this, we always ask the last question. And it is, what is your favorite guilty pleasure? And the reason I say that is because it's really, how do you self-care? What is the thing that you do just for yourself, Molly? And then, Maureen, I'm going to come back to you. What's the thing that you do just for yourself that really is like, oh, I love that. That's your self-care. That's how you really respect, love, and care for yourself.
So the thing about having a terminal genetic mutation is that I do many of those things, and then I get to blame it on the fact that I could have ALS in my young life. And then that's how I kind of, you know, I use the ALS card often or the genetic mutation card often. But I do get my monthly facials. That has been,
oh, I, you know, support that,
my self-care. And I take a lot of trips. I travel often.
I love that.
very often, and that's where I spend most of my money.
And Maureen, tell me about your self-care. How do you take care of Maureen? What's your favorite thing that you do just for yourself?
Just for myself, something I picked up from my mother that I would have never guessed that I would ever have any pleasure in, but getting my nails done on a regular basis, getting a manicure.
Oh, that girl, that is the truth. And I look at my nails and I'm like, oh, Lord.
So not something I would have ever paid for, took the time for, or invested in. But when my mother did get sick and required some you know, assistance to get to those places, the one place that she needed to be was to get her nails done. And she actually got her nails done on a Thursday, and on Saturday is when she took her drastic decline. So, you know, at this point, I make sure that my nails are done on a regular basis, and it really does, you know, help you feel better.
I love that.
Let me just say that it has been an honor and a pleasure to meet you guys. I look at your past experiences and they're so beneficial to everybody. Your present and what you're doing, your advocacy, your involvement in all these tests are amazing. And your future, because I know that it's just going to be amazing. All of the things that you do, regardless of diagnosis, I just, you're living a full life. It's all good. And I just thank you because you guys have been a blessing.
Oh, I love it. A full life. Guys, thank you so much for being with us. And guys, thank you for joining us on this episode. And until we confess again, we will see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Well, friends, that's a wrap on this week's confession. Thank you so much for listening in on UK Health Radio. But before you go, please take a moment to leave us a review and tell your friends about the Confessions show. Don't forget, visit our website to sign up for our newsletter and connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Twitter. You'll also find the video recording of all our episodes on the Confessions website and our YouTube channel. We'll see you next Tuesday when we come together to confess again. Till then, take care of you.